Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
Born in Zimbabwe, educated in the UK, experienced enough to advise the Labour government of Jim Callaghan on inflation, former chief economist at Goldman Sachs, chair of the BBC, founder of Active Private Equity, and chairman and founder of Fulcrum Asset Management, as well as a writer for the FT and Guardian, I'm delighted to have secured a free slot in your diary today. So Gavin Davis, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Well, I want to take you back because I understand that you were born in what was then Southern Rhodesia, where your father was a head teacher at a high school, and that was a tumultuous, febrile time as Rhodesia transitioned into Zimbabwe. Do you have any memories of that?
Oh, very much so, Simon. Yeah, I was just old enough to know what was going on with my dad in the school he was teaching in or was headmaster of, and of course became a dedicated South African cricket and rugby fan, which I've never been able to get rid of, sadly. So there you go.
Wise choice.
My dad was the founder of a black African high school, and it was the only such school in Zimbabwe at the time. And it became a big political issue as the Smith government was beginning to enter its last days. And we got deported. We arrived at Southampton. I was about 11 off the boat. And my dad and my mother had to find a new career. And I went to high school in Southampton and became a dedicated Southampton fan. So that's the whole history of my sporting calendar already.
Right, right. Well, you've got some mixed loyalties then. But I think that supporting South African rugby generally has been a winning choice.
Yes, my children don't like that, especially in the World Cup final of 2 years ago. They were extremely annoyed. But there you go.
Yes, several of those. But we live in hope. But just tell me, you're educated in the UK, and I know that you elect to go to John's College, Cambridge, and then I think you have a postgraduate at Balliol. But how did you weigh up those choices?
I always wanted to be an economist from very young teenage years. Strange ambition, but I did. And Cambridge was the place to go as an undergraduate. I went to St. John's, a great college, did well. And then I wanted to leave Cambridge for a bit, went to Balliol in Oxford, and was about to finish an MPhil in economics when I was asked to go and join the incoming Labour government's policy unit when Harold Wilson, largely by chance, won the election of February 1974, hadn't really got a game plan for his policy unit, asked Bernard Donoghue and Andrew Graham, who was my tutor at Balliol, and I sort of hitched a ride into number 10, which was a fluke. And was one of the many strokes of luck I've had, I must say.
Well, I want to just dig into that a bit because you were with Harold Wilson's policy unit and then an economic advisor to James Callaghan, I think from 76 to 79. Now, I like to think I'm an economic historian, but it was a time of immense economic turmoil. And I wonder whether you can just set the scene.
It was a period of oil shocks. It was in the middle of the two big oil shocks in the 70s. So we got a lot of inflation and recession from that. We didn't understand how a supply shock worked in those days. We didn't think about that in the same way that we would now as macroeconomists. But in addition, in the UK, we also had a big problem with the trade union movement and very, very rapid wage inflation. And we initially in that government handled that very badly. I'm hoping we will not do the same again now. We translated the shocks into 27% inflation at one point in 1975. And then the remainder of the time, we were recovering from that series of big problems. And I think we learned a lot. We kind of prepared the ground for Mrs. Thatcher's monetary counterinflation policy. The Labour government couldn't implement that because it didn't have the political strength to do it, but she did. And as in the United States, the 1980s learned the lessons of a very, very bad period for economic policy in the 70s.
Well, I think we're going to find ourselves in a minute getting right back into that in the context of today. And something does make me think, raise the question of whether we've come full circle, but I'm going to just pause because let's just stay with your journey. You switched to the city. I'm just always intrigued when somebody with such strong academic credentials, was it an automatic segue into financial services?
It wasn't automatic. I did think of trying to become a serious academic, Simon, but I don't think I would have been brilliant at it, actually. And I was always interested more in economics, in the impact it had on policy and on markets, than I was in the theoretical subject, although I still follow the theoretical subject as well as I can. But I kind of sensed that there was an opportunity in the financial sector, which at the time didn't really have any really serious economists, either in the US markets or the UK markets. And with a friend called David Morrison, saw a big opportunity to try to bring economics at a professional level into the markets. And there were others who were doing it, Tim Congdon, Roger Bootle, Gary Winglowski in the US, but we were in the vanguard of it. And we were able to ride that wave of a new subject becoming very relevant in the financial system.
Well, I know you went to Simon & Coates and then you end up at Goldman Sachs. And of course, you became the go-to voice at Goldman Sachs for many in the city. But you had obviously a very successful time there. How would you sum up your time at Goldman's?
It was a period in which Goldman Sachs was becoming a great international investment bank. It had obviously already become a great US investment bank. But when I joined the firm in 1985, it was small outside the United States. And believe it or not, people hadn't really heard of it. And David Morrison identified the opportunity and said, Mr. Davis, let's go and try and persuade Goldman to hire us. And it took us 2 years, actually, to persuade Goldman that we were good enough to work for Goldman Sachs. And again, luck. Goldman became very successful in Europe and then in the Far East. And we were providing them with the international economic research that they needed to grow their presence in international markets. So we were, in the end, in the right place at the right time. And we were able to benefit from the growth of Goldman as a global firm.
Well, I reminded another guest who was ex-Goldman's on the show that I also applied in 1985, but my application was rejected firmly.
Goldman makes big mistakes on its recruitment, Simon, so I've no doubt. And then you went to Morgan Stanley to rub it in.
Oh, gosh. Well, there we go. Long journeys and great fun. But so, of course, during that time, you serve as the Chancellor of the Exchequer's one of the wise men during the 92 to 97 Parliament. And I'm just sort of intrigued about, you know, these groups are assembled and governments like to do it, but did they really listen to you?
That was an experiment when we had just come out of the ERM. So the economic framework for macro policy was being reconsidered. And Norman Lamont decided that it would be a good idea to have this advisory council, and it was kept in place with Ken Clark. And it was five different economists. We all thought different things. It was a bit of a five economists, six points of view kind of system. So I wouldn't claim it was a fantastic institutional success. And what happened thereafter was that we all realized, that I certainly realized, that the incoming Labour government needed to have an independent central bank to set monetary policy. So there was a step between the exchange rate mechanism and the system that proved durable, the monetary policy system we have now. But for me, it was a big thing because it was a Conservative government. I'd previously worked for a Labour government. And I really liked, especially Norman Lamont, actually, people are surprised by, but I thought he was a much maligned chancellor, caught in a very difficult exchange rate crisis, which nobody could have handled very easily.
Well, we'll come back to currency later on. I think it was Theodore Roosevelt who said about economists, because he was fed up with the one hand, and on the other hand, he said, just give me a one-armed economist.
A one-armed economist. I haven't found one yet, Simon.
So let's switch channels. You spend time with the BBC, eventually becoming the chair. And as I've done my research, I was intrigued to see that you were quite vociferous in saying that they should invest in digital, and some of your suggestions weren't approved. So let's just maybe ask this question, because you have the benefit of having seen the institution evolve. How would you think the BBC should compete with the Netflixes, Comcast and Disneys of this world?
It's a lot harder, Simon, than it was in the late 90s. The late 90s, we were just seeing the arrival of the digital channels, and the Murdoch threat to the BBC was very evident. And under John Burt, the BBC was thinking carefully about how it would react. And I was strongly of the view that the BBC had a very valid, very important future in that new environment, and that we needed to fund it adequately, and that we needed to support its website, because it was already pretty obvious, actually, by the late 1990s that the web was going to become a much bigger deal than digital television channels. So we argued for the license fee to reflect the growth of digital TV. The government said no, but they did give a very high license fee award to enable the BBC to be a big player in the new framework. And I think the last couple of decades, the BBC has remained, has been able to sustain its position as the premier national broadcaster, not state broadcaster. I hate it when people call the BBC the state broadcaster. And I just hope that the new license fee settlement that happens soon will enable the BBC to continue that role. It has found it very difficult now to compete for sports rights, movie rights, even very big drama series against Netflix. The Crown is a Netflix series. But its role as the sane, rational, and I hope non-political, non-biased, non-partisan speaker of truth, in inverted commas, I think has been maintained. And this generation badly needs such a voice in news and in analytics and in current affairs.
I can't leave that topic without asking you, given the politicization of these channels, Fox News, Trump, etc., where do we go with this shift? I mean, in some ways, more towards communist channels and direction.
Well, I think we have to regulate news and opinion. And in Britain and in Europe, we do that pretty well, so that the private sector channels like Sky News are regulated and are very unbiased, in my view. I think Sky News has been a phenomenal success in the last two decades. Didn't exist when I was chairman of the BBC, really, hardly existed. But people like Adam Bolton as political editor and many others have been absolutely fantastic, I think. But that is in a regulated framework. In the US, Fox News and the equivalents on the liberal center of politics are very biased, I think. And that then segments the audience into a right-wing half and a centre-left, left-wing half. And they don't have a debate or a dialogue. And I think that's really divisive. And I think it's also made a lot worse by the social media, where you do tend to follow the people you agree with, and you're not really confronted with alternative points of view. That's always been the case with newspaper purchases, far back as we can go. But I think it's got more and more divisive. And I think the BBC is really needed to try to bring that together. I've got three kids in their 20s and early 30s. I'd love them to see the BBC as the source that they go to when they're in doubt about a debate. So the pandemic, what's the truth of the anti-vax campaign? I'd love them to assume that the BBC can help them through that. I know people think the BBC itself is biased, but I can tell you for sure it tries hard not to be. It really does. And that's at least a step in the right direction. The new chairman, Richard Sharp, close friend of mine, Tim Davey, the director general, I'm sure they're on board with this. And I would just love the Conservative government to make it possible for the BBC to remain in its important position in our national debate.
That's well said. Let's turn to Fulcrum. You were one of the founders. Your chairman started in 2004, and you're an independently owned asset management firm with core strategies around discretionary multi-asset absolute return, systematic risk premia, and alternatives. And you have been very successful in building a very large business with a global footprint. Maybe we just start with the mission and what drove this.
Andrew Stevens and I founded Fulcrum. We had worked together happily at Goldman. And you kindly didn't mention, Simon, but I had a bit of a falling out with the Labour government in 2003, leading to an early departure from the BBC. Very, very stressful moment in my life, I must say. Andrew called me up and said, "Gavin, listen, come back into the financial sector and we can do something together." And he wanted to leave Goldman at the time to found an asset manager. And it took one dinner and one handshake, and we're still together 20 years later, planning the future. And it's been a great experience. We wanted to be an asset manager with a macro foundation, which is what I thought I could bring. Andrew was a very successful money manager, and we thought the two skills could complement each other, and we're still trying to make it work as well as we can.
So we've got lots of players on the investment chessboard, and I wonder how you think about the role that you play when you're talking to families and allocators. Where do you fit?
Two things I would say. We are not just an equity follower. Most of our strategies do not have 100% or even 50% exposure to equities. So we're not going to match the equity market in a bull market, and we don't intend to. We hope that our various different skills and especially our knowledge of the macroeconomy will help us protect the downside in bad times for equities, so that over a cycle as a whole, we'll do well relative to other asset classes, but it won't track equities in the bull market. And that's pretty much what we've done. We have funds that are exactly the same, managed by the same people, as they have been for 15 years, roughly. So there's a long track record there with the same team doing the same thing. And it's a strategy that appeals a lot more after a bear phase in equities, but has been sustained for a long period of time now.
So that's a good time to talk a little bit about the allocation question around hedge funds. We've had quite a lot of debate on the Money Mates podcast from those, including some of your former colleagues at Goldman Sachs, with whom I don't agree, who have said that they no longer have a place and there's no offer in hedge funds. Maybe I'm just cynical and I just say, well, that's what happens after a 20-year roaring bull market fueled by cheap money. What's your view on the role of hedge funds from now on?
I think they have an enduring role, Simon. People say nobody allocates to hedge funds anymore, but it's $4 trillion of assets in hedge fund type instruments. And they have never attempted to match a roaring bull market, but they have, in various different guises, tried to add value to markets over a period of time and avoid big drawdowns. And that's more or less what they did in the pandemic. So in the pandemic year of 2020, hedge funds did pretty well, actually, and earned their keep in asset allocation over that year. Tougher year last year, but nothing terrible. And I think did what they said on the tin. Now, as we've seen from CalPERS, for example, one of the biggest endowments in the US, fees are an issue. We at Fulcrum don't charge hedge fund fees and don't think of ourselves really as a hedge fund at all. But one of the reasons that fees have become a pretty big issue for hedge funds is that interest rates are zero. Now, I remember in the old days of the 1990s, with interest rates at 5% in the US, you paid all your fees on day one, really, if you were a macro fund, because you knew you were going to earn 5% for your clients through the year just from your cash holdings, which underpin most macro funds. So the fees weren't that big of an issue. You paid your fees through the interest rate, really, and then the clients received returns on your skill for the rest of the year. That's not true anymore. So with interest rates at zero, fees are much more in focus. And for some endowments, that's become a big issue and is an ongoing story. How much can hedge funds charge for their services and will that be sustained? And I think the answer is if interest rates stay anywhere near zero, then fees will be compressed.
Well, I'm going to ask you this question in the wrong order deliberately, which is before we get on to talk about the macro and economic environment, what's different, do you think, in Fulcrum's asset allocation from your competitors today?
Do you mean the allocation that we currently have in the market?
Yes.
We have an allocation that can change rapidly. So I think within a month, it can certainly change. We have been somewhat cautious recently. I don't know whether that is more cautious than the market has been in general or than our competitors have been in general. And the reason is that the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, but the Fed in particular, is making a very big shift towards hawkish policy. And until they see the inflation rate peaking and coming down, they've been a bit late to the party, Simon, to be honest. They've been a bit late in making this shift. But from the December meeting, mid-December onwards, the Fed has become increasingly and more noisily hawkish. And we're trying to build that into our approach in order to safeguard against the possibility of a larger downturn in equities.
So this is where I think we're getting to the main course, because possibly if you were just an observer, one of the most interesting potential intersections of capital markets in the last 30 years. We talked about the Volcker arrival to extinguish that inflation. We've gone through this disinflationary 30 plus year period that's been most of our careers. And I would say that probably you've got Larry Summers in the US and you've got Gavin Davis over here. You are incredibly well placed to opine on this. Do you think central banks have just been too confident of their own ability and underestimation of inflation up to this point?
Well, I think the answer to that, Simon, is yes. But then there are many mitigations. The pandemic itself was unprecedented, and the way the central banks handled it was very good. And I think it avoided what could have been a catastrophic recession, much, much worse than 2008. And in fact, it has not been a recession of any kind, really, in the labour market. And that is to do with the central banks and to do with government fiscal policy as well. And I think it has been excellent. Now, from about the middle of last year, I think the central banks were a bit slow to recognise how big the inflation shock was, and then had to move rather abruptly in December. I think that applies to the Fed, but it also definitely applies to the Bank of England too. So they were a bit late, I think, at that stage. And even now, the Fed is still buying assets. This month, it will buy $60 billion of assets. So it's still easing policy further, actually, while its rhetoric is moving towards a catch-up, towards hawkishness. So yeah, I think they've been a bit slow to adjust to how big the inflation shock is, and also to the threat to credibility. This is really the worry, I think. The threat to the counterinflation framework's credibility, that the combination of easy fiscal policy and very easy monetary policy together might generate. It did generate a big threat in the 1970s. So people of my age and Larry's age in the US are more worried about this than the younger generation. I think now the central bank has undoubtedly realized the threat, and are moving very rapidly in the other direction. Maybe a bit too late, but they haven't done what we did in the 70s, which was ignore it for multiple years.
So, Gavin, I want to challenge you a bit, I suppose, because you use the word abrupt to describe their change of policy. And yet here we are with nominal rates still below 1%, real rates deeply negative. If you looked at this through the lens of the 1970s and 80s, you would go, what am I missing?
Well, I don't think it's as bad as it was in the 70s and 80s, Simon. So I don't think the underlying shock is as bad. It does have many of the same components. So a supply side shock coming out of energy, which I think will last for a while, and a very big fiscal easing, this time actually bigger than it was in the 70s. So those elements definitely exist. But the credibility of the framework means that expectations for inflation have remained very much under control. Not so much in the UK, actually, but certainly in the US and in the EU. So it's not, I think, an emergency. But I do think we're facing the need to remind people that the first responsibility of the central bank is to control inflation, which Jerome Powell is now saying. Are they still acting too little? Possibly. Are they acting too late? No, I don't think they are. I think they would be if it were the case that inflation expectations were zooming out of control with the target, but they're not. My worry, though, fiscal policy expanded in a completely unprecedented way. So debt ratios rose by 30 percentage points of GDP. Over the 2 years of the pandemic, everywhere, US, UK, EU, everywhere. That is being reversed now that budget deficits are being brought down sharply, actually. But the debt is still sitting there. And a worry that I have, and I'm sure the central bankers have, though they can't say it in public, is that that debt will somehow get to leak into permanent monetization and then leak into consumer prices. And that, to me, is a bigger worry this time, actually, than even it was in the 70s. So navigating that is, I think, the big problem. It's a political problem for the central banks and for governments, which may become a bigger story in 2022, certainly.
So I know you've been thinking about this. Is your thinking evolved that the impact of fiscal policy on inflation, if not emasculates the central banks, it makes them less capable of acting?
Yes, that's the worry, Simon. It could effectively subordinate the central banks so that they can't fully offset the effects of this very big increase in government debt and the monetization of that government debt in the central bank balance sheets. And there are two ways in which this can cause a longer-term problem. Larry Summers says, listen, this is just Keynesian. It's a big Keynesian expansion by the federal government, which is leading to inflation pressure in the normal way through the labor market, etc. And an alternative similar argument by John Cochran is it actually is not working quite in that Keynesian way, but the market is now seeing this amount of debt as unsustainable or less sustainable and is choosing to inflate away some of that debt because it doesn't believe these debt ratios are going to be sustainable. So either in just the excess demand way that Larry talks about or in debt sustainability arguments, which John Cochran talk about, these are potential threats. The Fed and the Bank of England have not really talked about this at all, but I know it's very much ticking away at the back of their minds. So they're thinking, how do we sustain a credible counterinflation framework against this backdrop? And they, I hope, will play their part in doing that, although the fiscal authorities have to do some of that as well. And we just need to normalize what is a very abnormal state of affairs for our macroeconomic policy framework, such that we don't lose the advantages that we gained from the 1980s onwards when we put in place a credible fiscal and monetary framework to fight inflation.
Yes, I suppose we're all reaching for the history books, and that inflation that came in the 70s really translated into investors in the US losing, I think, 70% of their real wealth between 68 and 81. And so as you think about returns and asset allocation for the next 5+ years, more or less equity and more or less US, given these obvious dichotomies in valuation?
Well, Simon, I don't think anything like what happened in that period in the 1970s is very likely. And the key reason for that is that I think the counterinflation framework will be robust and will survive these shocks. So on the one hand, I think action needs to be taken, and the Fed is saying that now. But on the other hand, I do think that action is not too late and will be taken. And on that basis, I think we'll have lower asset market returns than we become accustomed to. But I don't think they'll be negative for a 5-year period or anything of that nature. There may be an adjustment for 1 year or 2 years, but I'm not looking for negative real returns from equities. I don't think we're in that framework. If we let these inflation pressures get out of control, then the subsequent need to bring it back under control could put us into that framework. But I'm not currently that pessimistic.
So that leads me just to talk about currency for a while, because, of course, we all know that the enemy of purchasing power is this inflation, and the UK is the best example of what happens. I was looking at some data. Sterling, in 1969, £1 bought you 12 Swiss francs, and it buys you 1.25 today, as you'll know. But, of course, everybody's been in this game of currency debasement. How do you think about the currencies that you would prefer to have more rather than less of?
Well, I actually would rather have the dollar at the moment, Simon, because I just think that interest rates may have to rise at the front end more than is currently priced. And I think as long as the Fed speaks with the voice it is now speaking about counterinflation policy and credibility and keeping control of inflation expectations, then an increase in nominal short rates will be good for the currency. So the dollar has risen for most of the last 12 months against a lot of currencies. And I think that is more likely to continue. I don't see a big collapse in the dollar. I would expect that if I thought the dollar were going to see a very complacent Federal Reserve, but I don't. Now, the UK is a bit different. I do think Brexit, although by no means does it need to be a long-term disaster for the economy, is creating problems right now. We still haven't really done it fully, actually. We're still in the process of doing it. And the Bank of England's been a bit more, I would say, confusing about its message against a background where we tend to have a good deal more inflation in terms of expectations than the US does. And we've had recent, 30, 40 years ago, bad experiences with currency crises. So I'm more worried about the UK. Still think it'll be okay, but wouldn't select the pound over the dollar.
And as you're wearing your macro hat and one's thinking about a lower return world and some of these risks, maybe I'm betraying my age here, but would you, given its weakness as well, would you want to be adding currencies like the yen to your equation and maybe even the Swiss franc?
Certainly as hedges. They do need to be taken into account. In a big inflation shock in the world, Simon, those are the two big currencies that you would expect to gain. Japan is still not managing to create any inflation, despite all of the similar shocks to what we've had here. It's still, they hope, as high as 1%. So in a bad inflation environment for the world, with our central banks losing credibility, then you definitely would want Swiss francs and yen. But in the more likely example of a Federal Reserve that does do the job, then I think the dollar is to be preferred over those two. So yes, they're great hedges against inflation, I think.
Let's turn to private equity. You were a founder of Active PE. You've been a very successful investor, as I have discovered. And there's a lot of money sloshing around, clearly a lot of it destined to this as the alternative asset class. How do you, having seen so many of these trends, how do you process the tsunami of money destined to this category?
It's facing a problem of deployment now. The amount of money that has been deployed in the last 5 years has been massive, and it's carried on coming in. You said earlier maybe hedge funds are not attracting new flows. They are some, but not big flows. But of course, we are seeing big further flows coming into private equity, all types of private equity. And we've got pretty highly valued assets now, private assets, that are either being purchased in the growing phase of their lives, or it's easier to finance new venture entrants into the market. So the market is much more competitive. And I suspect this will not be a hugely good generation of private equity investments. So private equity has always been an area where the skill of selecting the asset and then looking after the asset and growing the asset pays off. And those skills will still be critical. But I think the asset class is going to have a tougher time just because it is now so crowded.
Two more micro questions on PE, though. You're a, what Americans might call, a data guy. You're very rightfully reliant on and utilizing the data. When you are sitting there wearing your PE hat and a business comes to you with a proposition, on the one hand, you've got the projections and the modeling, much of which can be difficult to do, and you've got the people and the ideas. And how do you balance those two factors?
Depends on the history of the company. So a company that is already established in a market and has a plan for growth, you can look at the numbers and you can make a judgment about whether you think the team can deliver that and the market can be conducive to that. But at an earlier stage, it's more about the people, really, actually. The number of business plans that we see that look fantastic until you actually try to start the company is a large number, as you can imagine. And so the ability of the founders in a small company to navigate shocks, live with shocks psychologically as well as how they handle their company decisions, is critical. And to find people who are appropriately determined is the key, really, at that stage of the company. So we need both. We need business plans and we need teams. But if you give me a choice, I'll pick the team.
And I want to follow that. I was listening to a senior executive of Sequoia who recently said he wanted managements that were more missionaries than mercenaries. How do you weigh those up, given that the world is increasingly looking at the issues of sustainability?
Well, it's encouraging that Sequoia would say that, because you wouldn't necessarily pick them as the most obvious example of somebody who would say that. So it is great that Silicon Valley has started to smell the coffee, Simon, I guess you would say. But I think the first responsibility of any privately owned company is the shareholder and the staff and the customers. It is the normal business responsibility. But I think in the last few years, it's become completely obvious that you have to have some kind of missionary zeal. The company needs to have, to really be a big success and to appeal to employees and customers, it needs to have a greater purpose, actually. And companies that do have a greater purpose hang together better, I think. That doesn't mean they can forget about money. And sometimes I see it in our portfolios, management teams that forget the shareholder interest, they're normally not going to succeed. I've seen many companies with a not particularly attractive business plan do well because they've got a great management team with this good mix between mercenary and missionary. But I've never seen it the other way around. I've never seen a great business plan work without a great management team, ever. I think the world has moved on. We need to have a realization that we are part of a community of citizens and not just a group of people making money and to hell with the rest of the population.
John Donne, no man is an island. I knew there were going to be so many things I wanted to ask you, and I'm always conscious of your time. I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions, and you're going to try to give me rapid-fire answers, but I'll excuse you if you feel too passionate about some of them. Sir Keir Starmer, is he the real deal?
He's better than what went before, Simon. And by a very large margin.
Are we going to see a Goldman alumni going from Chancellor to Prime Minister?
Sorry, I hope so. Look, I'm biased, okay? I think Rishi Sunak was a massive success at Goldman Sachs since. And I really like him and respect him and think he's been a really good Chancellor. So I'm hoping that there'll be a step up in the incumbent at number 10.
What's your favourite daily habit?
This is going to sound ludicrous. It's travelling by bus into work. I have always commuted by bus. My colleagues at Fulcrum think this is a peculiar quirk, but I can read on the bus. I love travelling around London on a red bus and have not been able to do it during the pandemic. I miss it.
What's the book you would recommend for young people thinking about going into finance?
Depends on the level, I think. I probably would go with a macroeconomics textbook because I think almost every type of person in finance requires some kind of economic grounding. Paul Krugman's textbook, for example, would be a good one. If you haven't read it, read it.
Now, you've met lots of interesting people. Who's the person you who haven't yet met you'd like to have dinner with?
Alive or dead, as they say in the parlour game.
I am going to say alive.
Person I haven't met who's alive, Boris Johnson. I'd be fascinated to meet Boris, see what he's really like.
Right. Well, he may have some more time on his hand, Gavin.
Yes, I know.
Although if I'd ask you the question about the person who's dead, who would it have been?
Oh, well, then it's Lord Keynes, obviously. There's no doubt. We failed to overlap by 4 years in our lives. If he'd lasted 4 more years, he and I would have been on the planet at the same time. I'd love to have met him.
Now, would it be fair to say that you have invested with your heart more than your mind when it comes to golf?
I think that is fair to say, although, yes, it is fair to say, Cyrus. I have two amazing projects that we've spent in my family and with my colleagues 20 years building. One is called Vidabon Golf Club in France, which I think is just about the best in Europe. And the other is the Macri in Scotland in the Western Hebrides, which I think is a phenomenal golf links, which might make money. But I have to admit that the return on capital has not been outstanding yet on these projects.
Well, it's, I guess, illustrative of why one needs to be flexible in so many dimensions in one's life. And I've looked at the websites of both of those and they look absolutely fantastic.
Well, you can't be that flexible, Simon. You know, any more flexibility is not called for at this point.
On the subject of education, you will have seen that Professor Neil Ferguson is establishing a new university in the US in part to counter some of the great, what he would call, awokening. What are your reflections on what's going on in Western universities and education?
Well, I'm a bit alarmed at the idea that people should not be allowed to express their opinions based on their views and good research, etc. But we're having a period at the moment where in Western universities, even the great ones, even the best universities, are finding, some of the faculty members are finding it hard to express views, which are challenging to current beliefs and may be wrong. But they surely do have the right to make those views expressed. And university should be the place where you most can do that, where rationality, good argument, is able to be made, even if the inferences drawn from those arguments are unpalatable to many of current trends. So I think we do need to correct that, because a university should always be a place in which everybody feels free to express their underlying real opinion.
And my final question, what advice would you give to the young folks who listen to the Money Maze podcast thinking about financial careers?
Oh, I definitely encourage them to come into finance. It is the best industry. It's always changing. It's always fascinating. It has incredibly talented, engaged people. It has great clients. And the idea that we're going to be replaced by algorithms is much overrated. Human beings are not going to allocate money to algorithms. They want to see the person who's responsible for their savings. I would never regret for a moment being in this industry, and I would encourage anybody to come into it. It's a great industry.
Gavin, I was really looking forward to talking to you today, and you have not disappointed me. There has been lots of great stuff in there, and you've seen a lot more than many others. And so there's so much to take away. And I think if I'm wrapping up with a couple of conclusions, it's that you think that the central banks, particularly the Fed, is on this. And despite the rapid rise in inflation, is that there is maybe less complacency than some would suggest, number one.
Now, yes.
Now, I think that's right. Number two is that in discussing the volume of money headed into PE, you can't get away from the fact that it's the people driving those businesses that are absolutely paramount. Number three, we are in a world where there will be thinner returns ahead. Hedge funds play an important part in thinking about that risk management. And finally, that you are rooting for Rishi.
Well, I am, and Southampton. By the way, Rishi is a Southampton fan. So there.
Is he?
QED.
Well, look, Gavin, thank you so much for your time today. It's been terrific.
Thank you very much, Simon. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.